You're listening to Co-op Mood, a casually serious conversation about playing video games.
This is episode 16, Hades, the Bisexual Thirst Trap.
Catchphrase. I'm Sally. You can find me on Twitter at SallyT.
And I'm Shane. You can find me on Twitter at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
We're still kicking the tires on the old transitional phrase, Shane.
I know that you made that reference for me, but like it's a voice line from Overwatch and I love it so much.
Oh, good. Okay. Okay, cool. So we start each episode with a story from the world of video games that we think is fun or weird or enchanting or cool. Shane, what are we going to talk about today?
We've got an article here from Polygon about a new James Bond game coming from the developers of Hitman. IO Interactive made the announcement for Project 007 this week. So I am super excited about this because I'm a complete sucker for James Bond. And okay. Hitman is one of those franchises that does like the stealth secret agent genre true to form. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to see how that goes, because James Bond is one of those franchises that often sucks, right? Like, let's be honest. Like, a lot of the books aren't that great. A lot of the movies are pretty bad. Video games, other than GoldenEye, pretty awful. But like, it feels like this is the right marriage of like property and like ethos of the developer, right? Like, they get the secret agent, like hitman, sneak up and attack kind of like vibes of James Bond. So I think this is really cool.
Nice. Yeah. I'm a total noob James Bond wise. I don't think I've probably watched like 45 minutes to an hour of James Bond movies over the course of my life.
Really? You've never seen a full James Bond?
They just like, they never took. I don't know, but my brother Nick is totally scandalized because he's a big James Bond fan and he references the movies all the time. And I think it's a sign that I should probably like check out a couple so I at least know what's going on. I mean, I know, I get it. He's a handsome, suave secret agent and he romances the ladies and so on. Right?
Oh, man. You see, I think you would like the new James Bonds. Like the Daniel Craig James Bond is really like, it's not that anymore. Like it's not, it's not the campy kind of, I mean, you know, obviously he's still a handsome man who's going to womanize a little bit, but like he's a little more rough and tumble than he is suave.
Okay.
And I think he's a little more human. He gets beat up is what I'm saying.
Okay, nice. Well, I love seeing a handsome man get beat up, but I guess I always felt when I caught the old ones that it was just kind of rapey. I just feel like that was sort of the vibe.
Yeah.
But if it's less so now, I could see myself getting into it. And also, like, I love the Hitman games. I am very bad at them and don't play them the way they're intended to be played. But they're so fun. They're like such a great marriage of like stealth and puzzle, which is really fun for me because I like solving puzzles, but not really like visual puzzles. I like a logic puzzle, I like a word puzzle.
Like a good Sudoku.
I love a good Sudoku. And like the Hitman games are just that. They're fun and creative and you can solve the puzzles any way you want, including very messily and badly like me. So I'm definitely interested in this. The teaser trailer, I just feel like the word teaser is doing a huge amount of work. It's less than a minute long and all you hear music and you see sort of, I don't even know, what do you see, like logos and like, what do you see in this, Shane?
You see a really nice render of like the iconic like introduction to Bond is really what I would, right? Like it, cause it's just following along that little spiral pattern that has the circle that James Bond famously walks through in silhouette. You know?
Okay. Like, that helps me. Okay. Now I can understand why this would be a really exciting teaser trailer then, because you're like, as a James Bond fan, this is doing all the right things. And they're signaling to you, like, we understand this franchise and we're going to create something really fun for people who are into it.
I mean, the trailer is not good. Don't get me wrong. Like, it is the teasiest of teases.
It's very teasy. But I'm psyched for this. I totally could get into it. Hitman 3 is coming out in January, I think, which I'm really psyched about. So yeah, I'm psyched. Do we know when this is coming out?
I didn't see a date in the article, but it is coming out for PC, PS5, and Xbox Series X.
Okay, cool. Well, when I get a PS5 in 2022, I'm going to be psyched to play this.
Yeah, this is coming about the same time the PS5 comes to store shelves.
Yeah, precisely. Okay, sweet. Well, with that, why don't we talk about what we're playing right now? Shane, talk to me. What are you playing?
League of Legends Season 11 preseason. So got the new patch, got all new item reworks. Mythic items are now in the game, and all the champions that you know and love have changed. So it's like I spent the past few months learning a game for them to completely turn it on its head and tell me to learn all over again.
Now, is this something that is intentional? Like they do this every so often and it just makes things really fresh? Or did they sort of like overdo it and now things are sort of too new?
No, I mean, they've done major reworks in the past. Granted, I have not played the game for most of its 10-year history, so I don't know exactly what those were. But what I understand is they've done these types of major reworks in the past, not necessarily of items, but of systems. And so this year, they happen to do items. They telegraphed this. I mean, everyone knew that these were coming. They were in like the test environment for a while, and now they're deployed in preseason, right? So it's not affecting people's rank or whatever as they play through these champions. So, but the meta's changed a lot. One of my favorite champions, Amumu, who is the sad crying mummy, is now one of like the top win rate champions, which is, it's, you know, been a while since he's been up there. So
gotcha.
Very happy to see the sad mummy.
Yeah.
A couple of my champions got completely nerfed into oblivion. So oops.
Will this balance out eventually? Or, they're still working this through?
Oh, totally. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they've already had a couple hot fixes for some bugs. They've got, you know, patches are coming like on a 2-week cycle. So it's going to keep changing until like January when the new season starts. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, cool, big patch, new meta, you know, new problems to solve, new things to learn, keep the game fresh. So I'm excited about that.
Nice. That sounds really fun. I love it.
What are you playing right now?
Okay, I'm playing, first of all, I just started Breath of the Wild for the first time, which, as you may know, is many people's favorite video game ever that has ever been created on the planet Earth.
Including possibly your partners.
Yes. Andrea loves this game so much. It has like totally replaced Animal Crossing, which itself replaced Stardew Valley. It's really fun to see her get into a really like video game. Mm-hmm. And she's been helping me play. She's been like telling me about like armor and weapons, and it's so fun to see her play like a gamey game. It's beautiful. It's cool. I don't connect instantaneously to the Nintendo universe, the Nintendo family of products as other people, but I recognize that it's like awesome and cool and the story's great and looks really cool and it's really fun. And I think I'm going to be playing it for years because I think it's like 1,000 trillion hours.
That sounds like an accurate estimate.
Yeah. So the other game I'm playing is Watch Dogs Legion, and I want you to picture, Shane, the clown emoji as I tell you this, just in place of where my face is.
Okay.
And the reason is, like, I didn't play the first Watch Dogs. I really liked the second Watch Dogs, even as I recognize that it's like kind of a middling open world Ubisoft property.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of game you play where you're like, this is blowing the world of video games wide open. I never imagined I would do this in a video game, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
By any stretch in the imagination. However, it is a game where you get to go shopping for different clothes and change your outfits a lot, which means it's my favorite kind of game.
Yep.
So, okay.
I understand the appeal now.
Yeah. So I got Watch Dogs Legion being like, okay, I'll be a cool hacker. I'll buy cool clothes. Now, I just want to say, speaking of things that have been nerfed, the ability to put together really dope outfits has been nerfed.
What?
Like the clothes that you can get just aren't as cool, and they don't look. There's now, granted, I'm playing this on a PS4. I'm not playing this on a PS5, so maybe you would get major like next gen vibes if you played this on what is now the current gen. But like the clothes like sort of don't lay in, and I know that like people, like designers give up like basically years of their lives and time with their loved ones to design like a pant leg that like falls in the right way. So I understand it's no small undertaking, but like there's something about the character movement and the way the clothes fit that just doesn't, it almost looks like last gen to me. Like, mm-hmm. And the clothes themselves aren't as fun or as cool. It takes place in some sort of like not that far into the future. Maybe it's an alternate present, but the style is just weird. And anyway, that's not my primary concern with the game. My primary concern with the game is that like basically it takes place in London and you are a member of this hacker collective called DedSec. And the thing that everyone was very excited about with this game is that you get to recruit any NPC in the world who's like walking around. You can recruit them and then they become a playable character, which is cool, except that like what really ends up happening is that like it just reminds me of playing an RPG where you can kind of switch between builds or like move skill points around or something. Like it doesn't feel like meaningfully different to play these different characters. So that feels like that was overhyped, first of all. Second of all, these Ubisoft open world games, like there's something that feels so empty about them. Like there's a lot of stuff in the world and, you know, you might look at someone playing Watch Dogs running around, like interacting with the world and think like, wow, there's a lot here. But I feel like it's very wide, but not very deep. Like there's something that just feels like, first of all, it feels very samey in terms of what Watch Dogs 2 was. And also it just doesn't, I feel like this particular game was promising like a kind of deeper experience and it's just not delivering for me. The other thing is that the fucking plot is really annoying. It's like this very, it's like when a huge corporation that like has really bad workplace culture problems makes a game about an oppressive corporation, it's just like, it's embarrassing. Like I feel embarrassed playing a video game that has some sort of, in theory, some sort of like subversive message, but it's like kind of the least subversive thing in the whole wide world. So anyway, I guess the thing is I'm still playing it because like I said, I'm a clown and it's fun. Like it's fun gameplay. There are some really good stealth levels. Takedowns are kind of fun. There's some really annoying levels. There's one level that's played entirely in the dark and you have to use a drone that is able to illuminate a small circle of light. You move 2 feet, activate the drone. Move 2 feet, activate the drone. It's so fucking annoying. And I can't imagine. It's shocking to me that someone created this level intentionally, but I think they did. Anyway, the point is, Shane, bit of a mixed experience. I feel like I'm eating a meal that like doesn't have a good aftertaste, but I can't stop eating it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're at a nice restaurant. So you can't say anything about it.
Yeah, that's my full report on Watch Dogs Legion. I feel like it would be a good game to buy if it was on deep discount, which it will be in like 2 years. And
like 2 months, just, actually.
Yeah, maybe. And you just want an open world game to mess around in. But man, I really do miss all the outfits of the second Watch Dogs.
Yeah. You know, I kind of had a similar experience with Watch Dogs 2 because I got it when it was free on like Origin or whatever, like relatively recently. And like I played around with it. I got to like the open world unlock part and I was just like poking around. It was like, it was San Francisco, which isn't a city that I really feel anything for. And like, it, yeah, I kind of had a similar thing. I was like, this is like, I know what Ubisoft is, you know, like it just feels weird. And like the gameplay was fine, but like I also got stuck at a part that just had no signposting. And I was like, what have you expected me to know what the core gameplay of Watch Dogs is when I showed up? And that's kind of garbage because I didn't.
Yeah.
So like the fact that I was supposed to hack through cameras in order to like, you know, jump 6 cameras to get this door unlocked is like, okay. Needed a little help here that was the way to do this, but whatever, it's fine. You know, it's just like, I don't know. Watch Dogs, I get that it's a beloved franchise, but it never landed for me. So you're kind of listing some of the same reasons it didn't land for me. I'm kind of happy I skipped it, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. I think that part of it is like, when someone tells you that like you have to see this movie, it's amazing, and like you keep hearing that and then you see the movie and you're like, it wasn't amazing, and then it feels really disappointing. That's how I kind of feel with Watch Dogs Legion, like the hype around recruiting. You can recruit the old lady, whatever. I could complain about Watch Dogs Legion forever, but I won't. I think we should move on to our main segment. We're going to talk about Hades.
Yeah, so this will be part one of our discussion of Hades. So Hades is, of course, a roguelike with skill advancement between your runs. So as a roguelike, it's a procedurally generated dungeon. You make your way through. You fight your way through. And as you, you know, unlock different rooms, they have different rewards. What makes this one a little bit different is you have skill advancement. So as your character actually like gets better and runs get easier over time, you get one of six weapons, each of which are upgradable into different variations. So you get an attack, you get a dash, you get a special attack, and then you have a magical cast. And throughout the runs, the loot that you're looking for are favors from the Greek gods that change your abilities. They might, you know, add a deflect to your dash or add damage or push back to your cast or, you know, add crit chance to your attack, you know, depending on which deity. They all have a different theme, right? Like Poseidon does knockback, Demeter does like cold effects, chill effects.
Is it Dionysus who does like the hangover?
Dionysus does. Yeah.
Like they're all like drunk effects.
Yeah, that's a damage over time called hangover.
Nice.
And there's also duo effects too. I don't know if you've gotten to those yet, where if you get certain abilities, like certain boons from like two different deities, you can unlock like a duo ability.
Ooh.
So it'll be like, you know, the party never stops or something. It's like in Festive Fog for Dionysus, like it does more damage on the stun effect or whatever. Like they have different things where they like kind of cross over and like their effects magnify each other. Yeah. So there's those. And then there's also Daedalus hammers, which are a way to modify your weapon. So like they'll give you like multi-attack or increase your range or like change how your special works, things like that. So there's like a couple like, you know, you choose which weapon you start with, but your build path is randomized based on sort of what you uncover in the dungeon.
We should probably say, like, we're not going to not spoil. Like, we're going to talk about the story and how the game works, but we're not going to do, like, major story spoilers, right, Shane, when we talk about this?
Yeah, I think for this episode, we will try to keep it general enough that you can go play the game without being spoiled. And then next week, we'll come back and talk spoilers.
Totally. Yeah, so I haven't played as much of this game as you have, but I thought maybe it would be good to talk a little bit about the story, the setting, the theme, the music, kind of some of the aesthetic stuff. And then we can kind of talk also about some of the more gameplay things as we go.
Sure.
So in this game, you play Zagreus, who's the prince of the underworld, the son of Hades, who's trying to escape the underworld. This is a game by Supergiant. Shane, have you played Supergiant's other games?
I haven't, but I feel like I know them very well because this game was in early access and got streamed a lot. So I knew all about Hades coming in from months ago. And like when I finally got it, like when it was released, like it was a little different than what I had seen.
Mm-hmm.
But like I've heard so much about Supergiant. Like people love Supergiant games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've played Bastion, which I really liked. I played Transistor and I couldn't fucking understand it, so I gave up. But
yeah, I think Bastion is the one that like everyone points to as like this is the masterpiece, right?
Yeah, it's great. And I think Hades has a lot of, you can see a lot of like the Bastion in it. Really awesome voiceover, really, really stylish, really awesome art. This game is about the Prince of the Underworld trying to escape not just the underworld, but also like the dysfunctional family he finds himself in. Zagreus will come across various Olympians who try to help him out. And also there are a bunch of chthonic gods. That's a phrase I learned from this game.
Vocab words.
Vocab words. Chthonic gods are the deities or spirits of the underworld, according to Wikipedia.
Okay.
I have like very little Greek mythology background, which is why you're going to hear me pronouncing things all kinds of which ways. So I'm learning a lot as I play this game. My understanding is that the gods in this game, like a lot of the stories kind of they're ripped from the headlines of Greek mythology, but some of them have been kind of tweaked for the sake of the video game.
Yeah, that sounds true.
Yeah.
Based on my limited understanding of Greek mythology, like I will say they at least, the gods that you run into are at least playing according to what I remember about gods.
Yeah, right. It's like it fits. It seems right.
Yeah,
so I think like for me, and I think for a lot of people, the most striking thing about this game is that it is the horniest roguelike I've ever seen. It's actually one of the horniest video games I've ever seen.
It's incredibly horny.
It's so horny. So we were told, I think before either of us started playing, that this game was a bisexual thirst trap by our editor, Lucas. And hoo boy, is it ever. This game is full of like the absolute hottest gods you've ever seen. They're not just like hot, but they're also like, they're interacting with you and one another in just a very flirtatious come hither kind of way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you've got like Aphrodite, right? It's like one of the gods. And she's not the horniest, though she certainly isn't like lacking in like dripping sex appeal either. There's also just like, there's just a lot of flirtation through like everyone. There's like, there's love triangles that you uncover through different like elements as you move through. Like even the first boss, you kind of have like a flirty thing that goes through. Like, and since, you know, you face the first boss in every run, that story gets pretty developed.
You know, like in movies where there's like a man and a woman and they're really mad at each other and they're fighting, and then like 2 seconds later they're like making passionate athletic love.
Yeah, that's like the Mr. and Mrs. Smith effect.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of that, at least in the first boss. So when I was like doing research for this, I was like, obviously I have to learn more about why this game is so horny. And so I watched an interview, which we'll include a link in the show notes, with the art director at Supergiant, who is named Gen Z. And Gen Z said that the sexiness is intentional. And she said that it was premeditated in that I wanted every character in this cast to be sexy. She said ancient gods like us were fans of the human form and beauty, and they celebrated it a lot. And so she took that as carte blanche to make everyone really hot. And this was in an interview with the Supergiant team, or at least part of it, like four of the people on the team, who is the same team who has made all of their games, like that they're known for. Mm-hmm. And she said that I believe I showed a fair amount of self-control, because initially when they were developing the game, she said she was on a rampage about how every single character should be completely nude because Greeks love heroic nudity.
Right.
And she pointed out that gymnasium means a place to train naked. So I love that, like, the art in this game. And by the way, the art isn't just horny. It's like completely beautiful. Like
it's gorgeous. Yeah.
You know, I would get prints of like this video game art. I love that what you see in the game is like the artist having exercise self-control.
Yeah. It's oh boy.
I want to see like the director's cut of this game.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. The way the art comes through is actually a lot of just still art, like line art. You know, like it's character portraits that come up as you know, uncover a boon, you know, a little icon or little, like, you know, portrait of the god that you're getting a boon from shows up, and they give you a little speech. It's all voice acted, and then you choose your boon. But like, yeah, I mean, they do a lot of work. I mean, for a game that is ultimately like fight your way out of hell, like there's a lot of story here. There's a lot of horny here. And it's fun. Like that's it's like, it's campy in its way, but it's also just like, you know, like you can feel like the developers had fun with this. They knew, like, you know, it feels like a Greek story is the thing, you know, is it just has that feeling of like, it's very messy. It's very entangled. Like if you know anything about Greek mythology, like, you know, about like the philandering and like just general laissez-faire attitude that deities have of like each other and mortals and whatever. And like, it feels like you are thrown into the middle of this dysfunctional Olympian / Chthonic family. And like, yeah, these are the horny gods you know and love. Like,
totally.
Fortunately, less rapey, but just as horny.
Right. Yeah. You know, when I heard that this was basically a hack and slash dungeon crawler roguelike, I was like, well, those are three phrases that don't make me that interested in a game.
Yeah.
But the story is awesome and totally there. And this is like, this is a game that is like fully voice acted. There's a 2.5 hour soundtrack, which is fucking amazing, which the composer described as Mediterranean prog rock Halloween music.
Yep.
And he also voices Zagreus, which is cool, but I'm mad that he's so talented as both a voice actor and a composer. It's like, please have one talent like the rest of us. But like,
Zagreus doesn't say that much. So.
He doesn't, but everything he says is so, this is the thing about the voice acting in this game. You know, it's not like a hugely dialogue heavy game, but it is all just the voice acting is just really good. And it's like you said, like they had fun telling this story and they're telling it earnestly. They're not, you know, it's a little campy, but nothing about it is like ironic or over the top kooky. It really is like a story about someone trying to escape their dysfunctional family. Just
right.
Very stylishly and with very, very horny gods in the mix.
Yeah. So I guess we should talk a little bit more about how the gameplay kind of reinforces that story, right? So as you mentioned, there are several levels of the underworld to fight through. If you know anything about the Greek underworld, like these places will be familiar. But you start each run in the House of Hades, which is literally the house in which Hades presides over the underworld. And then you pick your weapon and escape to Tartarus and fight your way up from there. There's a boss at the end of each level. And then when you defeat them for the first time with a weapon, you get a major boon. And then you get kind of a bunch of like currency every time you beat them afterwards. So I think the key here, like the innovation of this from a roguelike perspective, is that every time you fail on a run, you net resources to permanently improve Zagreus. So you'll use those currencies basically to unlock new options or new abilities for Zagreus, to add new features to the underworld. There's the like house construction engineer, which adds like capital improvements, part of which is like, you know, unlocking new areas of the House of Hades or just cosmetic things, but also like adding things like fountains, which heal you as you go through, like new types of encounters or new rooms you can uncover in the underworld. So like it improves it. And all of that is to eventually make runs easier for you, right? As you level up, it gets easier to win. So it's very unlikely you can win on your first run, but you know, by your 40th run, you should go pretty far and probably be able to escape.
I just want to say, like, to that point, one of the reasons I generally do not gravitate towards roguelikes is that they are sort of inherently known to be like very difficult, like very challenging. And this game, I do find it difficult. I'm not that good at it, but it's not prohibitively difficult like a lot of roguelikes. Like they've built in a lot of things to make the game more accessible. And I was reading about the game on the Supergiant website, and they talk about how many things they've built in for people who want it to be easier, for people who want it to be harder, for people who want it to be like incredibly punishing. So that's like, I think an important thing to note is that you don't have to be obsessed with like optimizing builds. You don't have to be the most, you could just go through and like spam buttons. I think, you know, you have to make some strategic choices, but like it's, to me, it is not prohibitively difficult in a way that I experience a lot of roguelikes.
Yeah. And I like, I never play with difficulty settings because I pretty much play it on normal. Like I feel like normal is the way the developer intended the game to be played. And so I put it on normal and that's how I feel like, okay, cool. Like I'm an average gamer. If I don't have fun on this, then you missed the mark, developer. I know you play with difficulty a lot more than I do, but like I thought it was really interesting that they have a difficulty setting. I think it's called, it's like godlike or something.
God mode, I think, yeah.
God mode, where you like literally level up by failing. So every time you fail a run, like your base stats get boosted a little bit.
Your damage resistance goes up.
Okay, yeah. Which just makes future runs easier, right? So like, by failing, like you are guaranteeing that like over time you will erode the game so that you can continue to advance. Because that's like, that's an important part of roguelikes, right? Is like you can't short the encounters. You can't make the encounters, like you can't make the enemies easier. You can't change the RNG. So like what do you, like what lever do you have left to pull? I think that's a really interesting one. And the fact that it ramps up over like time as you fail, like to me, that means it's going to like kind of naturally set itself at the difficulty that matches your skill level.
Right, exactly.
Which is just like, like many things in this game, like a very elegant approach to a concept that probably has existed elsewhere. Like, you know, like this isn't the first like horny story. This isn't the first like Greek gods. This isn't the first roguelike. But like, man, all the pieces just come together on this.
Yeah. 100%. And I think this game also, you know, I haven't, we'll see, you know, what I say, I guess, and what I think next time we record and we do the part two on this. But like, so far, this game feels to me like kind of the opposite of what I was saying about Watch Dogs Legion, which is that like, it's not very wide, but it is incredibly deep. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an open world. It's, you know, you're going through procedurally generated rooms, although each one is like, you know, handcrafted and hand designed. But like,
yeah,
the story and the gameplay and the characters are incredibly deep. And I always find it really exciting from a game design perspective when a game, whether it's a video game or a tabletop role-playing game or whatever, takes like, you know, three things you can do in combat and make them really interesting. Just this game, there's not a huge amount of moving pieces, but each one is really, really thought through and well-considered and interesting.
Yeah. There, you know, like I said at the top, there's, you have an attack, a special, a dash, and a cast, right? You basically have four buttons, except that you can dash attack, you can dash special, right? Like, and different weapons have like kind of different interactions with how they all work together. So like, it's simple, right? Like at its core, it's four buttons. But like, you know, if you want to like giga gamer this, then like you will figure out ideal combinations and like work, like different weapons will have you working like three hits of the attack with one Q, you know, depending on what boons you have, you're trying to like keep this, you know, damage over time effect like on the enemy, so you want to like filter it in this way, and like otherwise like these don't stack, so you want to separate them out, like, and like you can go like all the way deep, or like you said, like you smash the buttons, you know, like dodge the attacks that are coming and like hit them a lot and like wear them down. Like you could do that too. Like you can play with the traps in the environment or you can completely ignore them. Like it's all about play style. So it's, I think that's really interesting. And then like the way that the boons are randomized, the other part of it that I really like from a gameplay perspective, is the way the boons are randomized and the way the rooms are randomized and the encounters that you have are really what drive the story forward.
Mm-hmm.
So like it seems like the loop is like every time you hit a boon, you know, you talk to a deity. Every time, like there's certain encounters in each level that are like fixed, right? And every time you lose, you end up back in the House of Hades, where there are NPCs who are sitting around who have interactions with the deities and the, you know, other souls that you meet in the underworld, right? So like there are, for one example, is like Orpheus, who is the court musician of the underworld, right? The famous lyricist. Is that lyrist?
I think it, let's not even look it up. Let's just go with it.
We're calling it a lyricist.
Love it.
He's, you know, he's lamenting the loss of his muse. Achilles is there and has his own storyline of like, you know, a lost soul in the underworld. And also like he gives you the codex, which serves to check boxes and see how much stuff you've unlocked and how many areas are still there.
And there's my boy Sisyphus. Yeah, it does a really good job of taking gamey things and making them part of the story, which I feel like video games often try to do. Like I was thinking about in Witcher 3, where you pick up all these like books and it's like you're supposed to read them, I guess. But like a lot of the game is contained in the things that you read. But in Hades, a lot of those gamey elements are actually woven into the story in a really artful way. Like nothing really feels like tacked on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like as you unlock, like when you, the first time you like finish the first, like Tartarus, right? The first level of the underworld, like the first time you finish that, like everyone acts differently in the House of Hades, right? Like the story advances, right? You know, there are times when like certain NPCs are missing from the house and you can't advance your relationship. So one of the concepts is like you give them gifts, like you give them nectar to butter them up. And then that like eventually leads you to a, you know, some type of reward, as well as like more information about them and kind of unlocking more story. So as you do that, right, as you spend that currency on them, like the story advances for that god. You know, like sometimes Nyx isn't there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Hades isn't there. Sometimes Cerberus isn't there. And so like, it's like, oh, is that because that's because I did that thing. Cause I got that far. Cause I, you know, I unlocked that thing. Cool.
Yeah. There's a lot going on, which is, I think, makes the game feel really deep. And there's a lot going on in a way that for me can be sort of overwhelming. Do you want to talk, Shane, about like what we're looking forward to as we play more of this game, and also kind of what we're on the lookout for in terms of things that we might not like as much?
Sure. Yeah. Personally, I'm looking forward to endgame content. So I have finished the game, quote unquote, finished the game. So I have escaped. But the game has like a story mechanism by which you return to the House of Hades and then gives you a reason to keep going. And so, like, you know, as I mentioned at the top, there's six different weapons. So the baseline is like, hey, you should try to escape with all six weapons. Right. Or at least my baseline is I should try to escape with all six weapons because I'm that type of person. But then like I want to know like where it goes from here. Right. In terms of story, like as you complete runs, you learn more. There's NPC stories that I want to advance. And like I need to go like keep finishing runs to keep building those stories. So like I want to see what the endgame content looks like, because I finished it in a pretty like decent, like I don't know, like 20 something runs, I think. So like I, you know, I played it a pretty good amount. I got through it. Like I finished with the shield first, so I feel like I'm pretty good on just continuing to use the shield if I wanted to, but like I want to kind of bounce around other weapons now. And so like I'm at a place where like I am really playing it for the story now, and still enjoying the combat, cuz I'm still trying to like check things off lists and finish my prophecies and, you know, unlock my quests. So I want to see where that goes.
That's awesome. I, just to give you a sense of like where I'm at with this game, I think it was 25 runs before I even beat the first boss. So yeah, this is not as much of a Sally game as it is maybe a Shane game.
It's so much more of a Sally story than it is a Shane story, though. Yeah. Like dysfunctional horny family is more your wheelhouse than
mine. It's so true. It's so true. I mean, this game is just a very good blend of like story and, you know, optimization and strategy combat stuff. Yeah, I'm looking forward to like more of the story and also just more of the art, more of the music, more of the voiceover. This is a game that I find like truly a sensorially very pleasurable game to play. Just like the stuff you're looking at is beautiful. The voice acting is delightful. Just, it's just a lovely aesthetic experience, I guess. The thing that I am nervous about is that I'm going to get roguelike fatigue, which is that like, I don't want to keep doing, I want to be done with like the first level of the underworld. Now that I've beat the first boss, like, please let me just start at the second level. Like, but you know, that's not how roguelikes work. And so I'm taking a break from it, but I'll go back to it and play more for sure. But I do just feel concerned that I'm going to just sort of lose interest because I'm tired of like fighting the same rooms over and over and over, even though they're not technically the same. They're actually technically different, but it feels like you're doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I felt the same way in Tartarus too. In the first level, is like, once you've seen all the mid-level bosses, once you've seen all the map layouts, once you've seen like the end boss, like, it feels very perfunctory, and it just feels like something where like I just have to pay attention and not like lose too much resources up here, right? Because like the game for me really doesn't, like the risk doesn't really start until like the third level now, you know? And so that's like, that does feel like 20 to 30 minutes of gameplay where I'm just playing not to lose.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just seeing how is my luck going on my boons and how do I feel about my build path?
Right, exactly. And, you know, if you're like me and you're not as good at this game, it's not so much that you're like doing that 20 or 30 minutes like once or twice. It's like you're going to do it like 15 times and then the 16th time, right, like you'll get a little further. So the other thing that like I'm a little concerned about is that I tend to get overwhelmed when there's a lot of things to manage, like powers and objects and weapons and resources. And, you know, in this game, I think it's done really elegantly. It doesn't feel as overwhelming to me as it can sometimes or has in other games. However, the combination of like being a lot of there being a lot of things that you can sort of tweak and optimize with the fact that like it can feel very repetitive are two things that like definitely push me away, even while like the story and the look of the game and the experience of playing it is kind of like pulling me in. So
yeah,
you know, we'll see how far I get with this. I think that like if I end up not finishing the game, it's a matter of, you know, I feel like objectively this is like kind of an amazing video game. The question is like, is it for me? It might just not be for me.
Right, right. Yeah, I feel you on that. Like, it's a lot. And I even kind of got a little stressed out of like, when I spend a resource, am I spending it in the best way possible? Mm-hmm. You know, like when I unlock like plus 5% at this versus, you know, one extra use of that.
Right.
Like, which one gets me further faster? Right. And then same thing I feel like with advancing storylines, like some of them have like concrete benefits, like they unlock new things mm-hmm. in the game, and others seem to not do that. And like, nectar is a limited resource, so mm-hmm. I gotta go, like, if I get nectar out of my run, like, I don't want to go waste it, you know.
Totally.
And so like, I'm worried that I've like slowed down certain storylines that I'm very interested in, like the Zagreus Meg storyline. Like, I'm fucking all in on that. Mm-hmm. I want to know where that goes. Like, that's what's the horniest storyline of all.
Yeah, the Zeg. I'm sure Magreus. Have people like given it a name?
I don't know. You know that I don't follow those communities.
I know. I think that I just need to officially be on top of that so I can report back about the / fic about Zagreus and Meg.
Magreus.
Yeah, Magreus. All right. Well, so we're going to talk more about this and kind of our final impressions in our next episode. But anything else we should add, Shane, before we move on?
Just that it is, I think it's $25 on Steam. Interestingly enough, I'm playing it on mouse and keyboard. It's very much a controller game if you're into that. But yeah, I mean, it's a, like, it'll probably be in and out of being on sale, but I think I've definitely got my $25 worth.
Yeah, I think for sure. It's also on Switch, so that's another way play it if you want.
Oh, it would be, if commutes were still a thing that happened in the year of our Lord 2020, mm-hmm. That would be a very good commute game.
It's perfect, like, because you really can just dip in and dip out, although you can't save.
Yeah. You can save without giving up the run after you clear a room.
Okay.
So before you go to the next room, yeah, you actually can save. You just can't restart your run.
Right. Totally. Okay. So it is actually something you can kind of pick up for 10, 15, mm-hmm. 20 minutes.
Yeah. I do that from time to time.
All right, cool. So before we bounce out of here, let's talk about something we are excited about. I'm going to kick us off, if that's okay. I'm pretty excited about The Crown. The fourth season is now on Netflix. And the reason I'm excited about The Crown, I like it a medium amount. Like, this is not one of my favorite shows, although the first season, the Claire Foy season, I was completely obsessed with. Ever since then, I've been sort of like medium on it, but we just finished watching The Expanse. We stopped, like, very light spoilers for season 4 of The Expanse. There's so much body horror in the end of the fourth season of The Expanse that, like, neither I nor my partner could actually, like, stomach watching it. So,
is that the Hulu season 4? Like, the one that they produced after Sci-Fi gave it up?
Or Prime.
Amazon season? Okay.
I don't actually know when the switch happened.
Okay.
But I will say that, like, we were 3 episodes from finishing season 4, which is all that are available right now. And we just stopped and we were like, oh, we'll read Wikipedia because this is fucking gross.
Oh.
Yeah, there's just some specific, I think that, like, it's just specific to stuff that I find really hard to watch. Anyway, the point is, I wanted something that was like going to be absorbing, but was not going to subject me to weird extraterrestrial body horror and would just sort of be like a palate cleanser and an absorbing story. The Crown, I feel like, can be very cheesy. They do lots of like, they do lots of like metaphoric, like, there's this whole thing in like an early episode, maybe like the second episode, with this like stag that the royal family is hunting and like Princess Diana, and there's all the like switching back and forth between this like stag that's like limping and bloody and Princess Diana. It's very heavy-handed.
It's the only episode of the season that I've seen even bits and pieces of, and
so you know what I'm talking about.
Feel the same way.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, so we watch it and we just sort of like roll our eyes at it, but at the same time it's like very good, just easy comfort viewing. It's the you know, it's a very sumptuously designed, and you look at people's like weird English outfits and so on and so forth. So that's what I'm excited about right now.
And this season is the Princess Diana season, right? So it's like modern British history that you might even remember from your childhood.
Exactly. And I feel that Prince Charles has been very generously cast because the guy who plays him is a handsome guy and they gave him prosthetic ears, which is like not how I experienced Prince Charles, not to get into like the way, like looks shaming, but that if you're going to do something historically accurate, I think handsome guy with prosthetic ears is not it for Prince Charles. That's all I'll say about that.
I also think his approach to courtship is, I don't know. I really hope Prince Charles was slightly more suave than they wrote him in this season.
He's a hot mess. The entire royal family, the whole thing is just incredibly messy and very sad, actually.
Speaking of horny, poor Fergie was like, I thought she was going to die on the phone. Anyway, spoilers.
Wait, Fergie or?
Yeah, when Charles calls her to find out about Diana, like her face was just like, are you sure? You want to talk to my sister who's like a fucking nerd? And not like me, who's incredibly
horny.
And a child? Yeah. And like, also Jesus. Is 18, you old man.
God. Man, what a mess. Royal family, colon, what a mess. Oh, also, Shane, just quick note. That actually wasn't Fergie, who is Sarah Ferguson. It was actually Sarah Spencer that Prince Charles was talking to on the phone about Diana.
Okay, so obviously I wasn't sitting and watching the full episode. And also, there are too many redheads in British royal houses. Because I figured one redhead named Sarah, it's Fergie.
Right. No, I mean, it makes sense. There's also a million people with nicknames that have nothing to do with their actual name. So it's all very confusing. And I, for one, think that it's an understandable slip.
Well, I'm sorry that I misidentified the Duchess of McCorkinvale or whatever.
Shane, what are you excited about?
So still mooching that Apple Plus TV subscription from a friend of mine. So trying to use every part of the buffalo. Mm-hmm. Got into Tehran, which is a spy drama, which I think was interesting in the fact that it is set in Tehran and is a kind of cat and mouse drama between the Israeli intelligence service Mossad and the Revolutionary Guard counterintelligence, you know, within Iran. So it's, you know, the Israelis and Iran are at war. The Israelis are attempting to like insert an agent to conduct a mission in Iran. And yeah, basically things go awry. The agent has to go to the ground. They're trying to salvage the mission, you know, spycraft, thriller, etc. Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's like, I'm pretty sure this is like an all Israeli like production. Mm-hmm. And then like, but it's, you know, it's cast with, yeah, it's in Farsi, it's in Hebrew, it's like a little bit of English. So it's a little hard to follow, to be honest. Like you've got to be sitting at the screen to listen to it because I don't speak Hebrew or Farsi. Uh-huh. But like, it's just interesting because it's a non-Western spy drama, you know, and it's especially not a Cold War spy drama, which, you know, like I really like the Americans, like I really like that genre. And so like to have sort of the modern take on it that isn't like superhero spy like Bourne, it's, you know, kind of more grounded and realistic, but set in like kind of a modern conflict, I thought was really interesting. Though I am a bit concerned, having finished the season, that it's a lot of like pretty pro-Zionist propaganda.
Gotcha. Okay.
In
there
the way
it is.
They, you know, like, yeah, there's, it's not super in your face about it, but I don't know that I know enough about the conflict to feel like I can confidently say it isn't still a little like, you know, hyper pro-Israeli.
Totally. Yeah. That sounds right. I feel like that is how Zionism often shows up. I have heard good things about this show and I might also check it out.
The two leads are fantastic. Like for one thing, like it's a female led cast, which, you know, a woman spy who is tough and competent is not an easy thing to come by.
Yeah, totally. A rare story.
Yeah. Then there's the mark that she kind of like develops like a relationship with and kind of like becomes an asset, right?
Oh, nice.
He's also really great. I don't know anything about any of the actors in this, though. I did not recognize a single person.
Yeah. Well, I love a spy story, so maybe I'll check it out. pending like weird political messages.
Yeah. Report back on whether or not I was sensing it right or if I'm just dumb.
Nice. Okay, cool. Perfect. Okay, cool. Well, I think that does it for this episode. Please do rate us and review us. It helps people find the show and we would really appreciate it.
You can also follow us on Twitter at @CoopMoodPod with no punctuation. And you can follow me at @Mundangerous.
And you can follow me at @SallyT. And you can email us at coopmoodpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, send us your favorite Hades ships.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find us and other great gaming podcasts on the OneShot Network at oneshotpodcast.com.
Co-op Mood is produced by Shane and Sally. Edited by Lucas. Our music is Pixel Squirrel by Espresso Music. Logo design by Emily Cardamus.